You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
This morning, I caught up with National MP Christopher Luxon. We discussed the government's move to push through with Three Waters Reform, which will centralise water management in Aotearoa into four entities. Luxon started by explaining that he agrees changes to water management is necessary, but not in the way the government's doing it.
Yes, I don't want to confuse your listeners, but we do agree that there's need for change because you are right, there is ageing infrastructure. We see it here in Auckland with sewerage on beaches. We've seen it with lead and contaminated lead in Dunedin, and we had the Havelock North issue. What I'd say to you, though, is that the whole of the Havelock North issue, including Hastings and all the surrounding areas, was all fixed up for around about $80 million. And now to get all that water back into spec, which is fantastic and exactly as it should be. We do support the creation of this national water regulator because now we're going to have one body across the whole of New Zealand that sets the standards and, more importantly, enforces the standards and makes sure that the councils hit them and all these new water entities would hit them as well. And that's something that we've been very, very supportive of. But there are lots of other solutions and alternatives to delivering better water management in New Zealand that the mayors and councils themselves have been feeding back to the minister over the last 9 to 12 months.
And what are those sorts of alternatives?
If I take five district councils in Hawke's Bay, which is in Havelock North, where the problems actually began, they have all come and said, no, we're not supportive of this four mega water entities where 22 district councils will get thrown together. We actually have five district councils in our sub-region of the Hawke's Bay that actually like each other, would want to work together. We would continue to own the assets, but we would put them into what's called a council-controlled organisation, which would be sort of a separate entity that would then manage water in all five district councils across the Hawke's Bay, which are communities of interest. They are, a coalition of the willing. And essentially, the councils would still own the assets, and they'd still control and influence the organisation. And importantly, they could also get some benefits by having, a number of engineers and capability built in a centre that serves and understands their local area.
You said that households could potentially be paying more under this new system. However, Minister Mahuta, who's in charge of this, has sort of said the opposite, has said households will be paying more without change. How would you respond to that? She said it's going to save Kiwis thousands of dollars.
Yeah, so the problem is this now, which is essentially the minister started off by saying, look, we've got a $45 billion problem over the next 30 years. Remember, it's a 30-year sort of horizon and time frame. Then it moved to $90 billion, then moved to $120 billion, and then recently to $185 billion. So that's a series of consultants making a series of assessments and assumptions about what they think a gold-plated standard needs to look like here in New Zealand. I can tell you that's an eye-watering amount of money, and the fact that it's moved in that proportion in a matter of months just is really quite incredulous, because I can tell you, having run large organisations, made big capital investments around aircraft and other things over my time, when assumptions and financial models start moving in that regard and are that volatile in their assumptions, that's terrible. The minister, frankly, has had one idea stuck in her head, and she hasn't consulted, she hasn't engaged, she hasn't changed a single thing about it from day one. And that's why mayors and councils, and these are experts, these are people who know how to do this stuff. They
Is
care
there
about
not consultation happening now in this process?
No. It's all classic Labor government, another 250 working groups. It's another working group that doesn't include the mayors, and it's got some mayors in it, it's got some experts on it, it's got some iwi on it. It hasn't been formed. There's no terms of reference yet. Who's on it, who's off it, doesn't, no one knows. And frankly, the legislation's appearing in Parliament before Christmas in 6 weeks' time. So that is all just tokenism. It's a tweak, if anything, and nothing will come from it. And so it doesn't materially change it. It's just a concession because she knows she's upset so many of the of the 67 mayors across the country. So she's promising she'll keep looking into it. And like this government, like we've seen on everything, they like to talk about stuff, but they don't do it.
You and the National Party have said it would be repealed if you were to come into power. In general, do you think that is a good way for democracy to work, I guess, for new governments to come in and just overturn change?
Yeah, when it's a stupid idea, Noah, it's exactly what's needed, because otherwise you're just a lemming, mindlessly accepting that everything that you hear from the state is acceptable and is right, and it's just not true.
So here's a case where we'll
oppose it in the parliament. The government will pass it because they've got an absolute majority. The Greens are against it. We are against it. Other parties are against it. And we will oppose it. We'll repeal it. We get to government and we'll return those assets to local control. And as I said, the model we just talked about that the mayors themselves are proposing is a very interesting model where you'd look at that and go, okay, well, if Hawke's Bay wants to run their water assets, they want to hit the standard the regulator's going to ask them to hit, and we'll make sure that standard is hit. There's no sacrificing on the standard. Then, you know, that's up to them to work out how they do that, and if they want to work together doing that in a CCO or council-controlled organisation, we fully support that. And those assets, therefore, are in local control. They do have influence over that water entity. When they start charging differently or investing differently, they can make interventions to be able to change that. So, yeah, that's the challenge here.
I also want to talk a little bit about vaccinations and the latest updates around COVID-19. So this week, Judith Collins said she supports vaccine certificates but is worried they'll create two classes of citizens. However, just a couple of weeks ago, COVID-19 spokesperson Chris Bishop said vaccinated people should have greater freedoms than the unvaccinated. Can you clarify National's position around vaccinations and freedom and mandates?
Yeah, so look, I mean, just zoom out a little bit and sort of hit this, come back through the issue. First of all, we want vaccination certification and authentication. We wanted it yesterday. We've been asking about it for a very, very long time. And the reason very clearly is that there is no doubt in a post-COVID world we're going to need proof of vaccination for international and domestic purposes. You know, if you think about travelling internationally, it's going to be very much a case. If you think about all your listeners wanting to go to music festivals over the summer, it's going to be very, very important that we have vaccination certificates in place and proof of vaccination as a result. Every country, just give you a feel for it, because sometimes we get lost in what's happening just in New Zealand, but if you just zoom out, every country in the OECD, which is essentially the advanced economies of the world, has a vaccination certificate. We're the only one who doesn't have one. Now, we've been talking about it. We've been talking about it for a very long time. But this is the stuff that I've been saying to you over months now that is one of those practical management things that should have been delivered, because we know we're going to need it, but it's not happening at the moment. So we're talking about it, but nothing actually has happened. The second thing I'd say is that if you go back and look at our back in business plan that we talked about, what would we do tomorrow to help small businesses move forward? We're very supportive of businesses being able to use vaccination certificates and authentication for running their businesses, where they need proof of vaccination for customers, and then obviously they need to make sure that their employees, if they're going to serve those customers, are vaccinated as well. So we're very supportive of that.
So just to go back to my original question, though, could you sort of clarify, do you think unvaccinated people should have less freedoms than vaccinated people?
I personally think that the reality is if you've got 90% of people who, it's a bit like going, we have rules around no smoking, right, in restaurants. We didn't used to, but we do today. And so you can go to a restaurant, any of your listeners can go to a restaurant, and your enjoyment there is not offended by someone who's smoking beside you, right? So in many ways, it's the same kind of principle. And so the idea is that you've got to think about the freedom of the 90% that are vaccinated as much as the unvaccinated. Now, having said that, what Judith Collins was trying to say this week was that the tonality and the civility where we try to separate people into vaccinated and unvaccinated, we want to be making sure that we aren't being divisive. We want to be able to make sure that we can take unvaccinated people along on the journey and encourage them to get vaccinated. And some of the language that was starting to emerge where it was just a big pile in on the unvaccinated. I don't think that's the approach given sitting where we sit today. We want to encourage everybody to be vaccinated.
We just heard from National MP Christopher Luxon about the government's Three Waters reform and their move to push their plan through. We've spoken to Luxon a lot about it over the past few weeks, but I also wanted to hear the government's perspective on the whole issue. So joining us live is Local Government Minister Nanaia Mahuta. Welcome to the show, Minister Mahuta. How are you?
Good, thank you. Kia ora.
So I want to start by asking, why do you think there has been so much backlash to the Three Waters proposal?
Well, it's a difficult set of challenges to address. The systemic issue of underinvestment in waters infrastructure has been around for two decades. And effectively, I think many councils up until recently, as recent as 4 years ago when we started on our Three Waters program, really didn't understand the extent of the problem. And now that we have a solution, I think people are now rejecting the idea that we should have a solution, and they are wanting to go down a whole different path. But look, it's generally accepted now that we know the extent of the problem that the status quo is just not good enough.
So do you think local government generally has a good understanding of the issue at hand now?
I think in terms of the studies that we've undertaken, the information sets that we've got from councils, they have greater visibility over the health of their network, and what we've done through DIA is we've brought that all together to give a very comprehensive picture of the state of the whole network across the country. We've also commissioned reports to give us a sense of what kind of investment is required going forward if you take on board climate change, if you take on board the fact that some of the water's infrastructure are coming to end of life, if you take on board higher drinking water and environmental standards, so you're going to have to improve and upgrade existing facilities to be able to meet those standards. The costs are just too great for ratepayers, and that's why we're making the changes.
The thing I don't understand about this is, if it's as clear as you say, why is there so much opposition from, I think Christopher Luxon said 60 out of 67 councils do not support the proposal. Why? Where do you think this reaction is coming from?
Well, there's a high level of misinformation out there. One of the things I've said right from the beginning, that any reform that I steward through will be based on a public model of water service delivery. It's not a privatised system, yet there are still councillors or elected representatives who are out there saying that that is the case. It is not the case. The other issue is that right now, councils own water assets, so, you know, they will continue to own water assets in the new reform, and yet they're saying that this is a huge asset grab. It will not be. We can't take something we don't own, but we can legislate in a way that we're making more effective use of those assets for communities, ratepayers, and across regions. And then the other thing that I think is clearly misinformation is that this is going to take us down a path where local communities will miss out in favour of bigger communities, when in fact all the modelling that we've done and the cost benefits that accrue from scale and aggregation will mean that those small communities with a lower rate paying base, and often they are rural councils, they will actually get the best advantage out of the reforms that I'm proposing. So, you know, it's just a matter of trying to continue to work through so that people are dealing with facts, not fiction, and that we're looking for a solution, we're not staying where we are or indeed going backwards.
Well, you say that it sort of is a good deal for some of the smaller players involved. What about the larger players? I know Phil Goff has criticised it and sort of said Auckland's contributing a lot but not getting a huge amount out of it under this plan. Is it completely, it might be sort of equal, but is it equitable?
Well, it's simply not the case. Aucklanders will be faced with, over the next 5 years at least, of doubling of their existing water bills. So that means more money has to go into the system. And the reason why that is the case is because Watercare's balance sheet is tied to Auckland City Council's balance sheet. So Watercare can't invest any more than the debt level limit of Auckland Council. And that constrains a lot of their program. They've already deferred capital works, Watercare has, and they've delayed the time frame to be able to invest in these works. So, you know, I think many ratepayers across the country, including Auckland, I guess aren't that well informed of the extent of the problem, because the problem is only real if a pipe bursts in your street. If you find out that you're paying a little bit more in your water bill than you think is right, or if, you know, dirty water starts coming out of the tap or you get no swim notices, that's when people start to feel, hey, things are wrong and it shouldn't be this way. Well, I don't want it to be this way now or going forward into the future. So that's why we're making these changes.
I understand how significant misinformation can be in general, and particularly when we're talking about the public, I guess. But the fact that it's leaders and mayors and councillors who are opposing this, are they also affected by misinformation? Because that sort of surprises me.
Well, look, they're heading into their local body election period. It is what it is. But I've been really clear all the way through. If I can demonstrate that these changes bring household benefits to ratepayers, who, if you really boil it right down, are the key ingredient to ensuring that we are moving in the right direction, I don't think ratepayers want to be paying more for our inadequate service or the underinvestment in infrastructure. They want to know that they've got reliable, healthy drinking water, that they can swim in their beaches and that there won't be any no-swim notices, and that there won't be discharge going out into their lakes, streams, rivers and beaches inadvertently. So we've got to take it right back to the base one, if you like, and I think ultimately the benefits must go to ratepayers. And I know that with all the modelling assumptions that we've done and the information that we've given councils, we've shown them information that demonstrates what the value of the reforms will deliver back to households, and that will be lower costs for their water rates bill, but a higher level of service.
How much were local government figures involved in this process? Because it seemed like... Because initially you sort of, I think you said there was potential to opt out, but now it feels like it's been forced through. Has there been a lot of dialogue between central and local government?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good question. Thank you for asking that. This has been a four-year conversation. And because councils own these assets, right at the beginning we were talking about a voluntary opt-in approach because councils had all the information. And in order to get a really good picture across the whole country, we needed councils sitting around the table and being engaged in this pretty complex set of challenges to try and nut out what is the way forward. And for that to happen, we needed councils to offer up information. So, yep, I've heard the criticisms from councils who are contesting the numbers, but it's numbers they gave us. And so, you know, I have to push back and say, well, you know, every council spent last summer going through their books, giving us the information so that we could line up that information with the modelling assumptions and then give them really clear visibility about the reform process that I'm proposing and what the benefits would be to them as council, to their ratepayers, and then overall in terms of how they would meet the huge cost of ongoing investment in their infrastructure.
Other parties have said that while, because every other political party pretty much has called for the reforms to be halted as far as I can tell, and other parties have said that while water certainly does need reformation, just having four entities is perhaps not enough. Do you think the centralisation project is going to let local communities still be in charge of their water?
I think people who have been following this will see that this is getting the benefits of scale. This is about aggregating water service delivery. This isn't about centralisation, because the water network goes throughout the whole country, and you can't have the water network delivering water, for example, to Te Hapua from Auckland. It just doesn't work that way. So I think that whole myth of centralisation is not the right analogy for this particular issue. But if I come back to the question, it's really going to be important that councils and communities feel that they are a part of the solution. And so what we've done, one, we've acknowledged that Havelock North, which was that Kemphirbacter outbreak which led to five deaths and affected over 5,000 households, that actually had the potential to happen in many other places in New Zealand. So we lifted the drinking water standards as well as fresh water standards, the environmental standards. We've set up the dedicated water regulator to make sure that all councils meet those standards. We then went through the process of looking at water service delivery. What could we do to have a financially sustainable pathway? How could we fix that problem? But importantly, how could we make sure that every community, big and small, derived the benefits through councils and households so that we were in the best place possible now and into the future. So we're doing that, and that's why we've gone forward on the reform program. And then the next part of the equation is an economic regulator, which absolutely will make sure that there's consumer benefits and pricing that is more even and stable across the whole of the country. And again, that will ensure the performance of these entities is happening at the best rate, in the best way possible, and that we're getting cost benefits, procurement benefits and the like through economic regulation.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Minister. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Kia ora.
Kia ora. See you later. That was Local Government Minister Nanaia Mahuta on Three Waters Reform. We spoke to National and Labour, so we thought we might as well get the Greens on too for their perspective. So this morning I spoke to Green Party spokesperson for conservation, Eugenie Sage. She started by outlining the Greens' stance on the whole issue.
The Green Party supports reform in Three Waters. We've had historic underinvestment in our drinking water, wastewater and stormwater networks, and we do need to scale up some of the entities that deliver these services. Our issue, however, is with the lack of direct involvement by councils and the less democratic approach in terms of the accountability of these entities. They will be big entities, and councils are able to appoint representatives to a board that then appoints the competency-based board of each, of the entity. There'll be four entities around Aotearoa, so that's a much bigger scale than we have presently. And we think that the council-controlled organisation model is one which should help influence the way the governance and accountability processes work in the entities.
The broad structure of the four proposed entities, are you sort of happy with that? Other than the fact that a huge amount of mayors and councils are unhappy with it, do you think that structure is decent?
There could potentially be maybe another two entities to provide more of a sense of connection with community, where you've got the entity that spans both Nelson, Marlborough, Te Tau Ihu, the top of the south, and the North Island. There's not a great community of interest. It stretches from sort of Blenheim up to the Hawke's Bay. In terms of the government has said repeatedly that the ownership won't be lost, but it is being transferred from councils and the public to these entities. And we haven't seen the legislation yet. We think there does need to be strong protection around ownership. And the best way to do that is to ensure that the legislation requires a 75% majority in Parliament for any change to the legislation around the provisions around privatisation and public ownership. We saw with asset sales under the National Government how easy it was for a majority National Government to change the legislation and allow the partial sell-off of our energy companies, for example.
The government said there'll be the chance for debate around this and suggestions through select committees. Are you optimistic about that at all?
This is a major change in the structure of local government through Aotearoa, and there's only been a short sort of 2-month period for the councils to make formal submissions, and there hasn't been an opportunity for the public to engage. So the select committee process with submissions on the detail of legislation is quite technical, and it's not something I think that the wider public will necessarily feel that they really want to engage with the nitty-gritty of the legislation.
The National Party has said if this passes and they're in power in the next election, or I guess one after that, they would aim to repeal this. Is that something that the Green Party would support, assuming it goes through as it is now, in 3 years or 6 years, however long, would you support a repeal of this?
We want to work with government on this, and we want to ensure that we get a better design proposal which is more responsive to communities, which has stronger mechanisms for accountability and governance. There's a very real opportunity in these changes for much more involvement by iwi Māori. The boundaries of the entity for the South Island correspond with Ngāi Tahu's Takiwā, for example, and we do need that iwi involvement. But with having such big entities, ensuring that all of the North Island iwi, for example, are able to have a real role in the governance of those entities will be a bit more challenging just because of their size.
And are you optimistic that this better designed version is actually going to happen, when realistically, as you sort of alluded to before, the government can push this through completely by themselves due to the huge majority they have?
We want these reforms to be lasting, and so good policy is where you do get broad agreement across the political spectrum, so that you don't have a future national government, though that's unlikely at the moment given that their polling is so low, being able to just turn it on its head. There's too much lost opportunity, too much cost if you have a new regime set up and then a future government repealing that.
And a final question, how is it being in the Greens now that Labor has an outright majority by themselves? Do you feel like the government listens to you guys enough now?
There are areas in the cooperation agreement that the Green Party has with Labor, waste is one of them, where we do get to see cabinet papers and can provide comment on those, and a lot of that is behind the scenes, but the cooperation agreement is working well. There are other areas, I think, in the immigration space where Ricardo Mendez-March will advocate to the minister, will do campaigns, and sometimes government picks up our ideas, sometimes it doesn't. So it varies according to the issue, whether the issue is part of our cooperation agreement or whether it's not. But we continue to champion real action for the climate, reducing inequality and much greater protection for nature so that we've got a healthy planet.
That was Green Party spokesperson for conservation, Eugenie Sage, on the government's Three Waters proposal.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.